From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscoane. Poetry fans around the world are celebrating the 200th anniversary of the birth of Walt Whitman, the man affectionately known as the Good Gray Poet. Whitman was complicated, controversial, and wrote with a distinctly American voice. He came to be beloved around the world, but perhaps nowhere more than in Camden, New Jersey, where he made his home in the final years of his life. Of course, we invite you to join the conversation with a question or perhaps the name of your favorite Walt Whitman poem. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or call us at 888-477-9499. Joining us to unpack Whitman's life and legacy are Tyler Hoffman, professor of English at Rutgers Camden, and David Blake, professor of English at the College of New Jersey and author of two books on Walt Whitman. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So why was Walt Whitman and why is he, David Blake, so important to American literature?
Walt Whitman had the incredible task of inventing American poetry. For decades before, even a century before, people had been trying to create a kind of poetry that reflected our nation and our democracy. Whitman was the one who did that. He lengthened the line of poetry. He got rid of rhyme in most cases. And he really tried to write a poetry that reflected the spirit of democracy in the New World.
Hmm. Tyler, what do you say about that? Your observations on why he's so important in American literature?
Well, I agree with what David said. Emerson called for the poet that Whitman was or became. Emerson lamented the fact that we did not have an American poet worthy of the nation, or one that took the nation seriously as a subject. And Whitman arose, actually having heard Emerson give his lecture about the need for a new kind of American poet. Whitman arose and embodied that. And I think the fact that he takes such quintessential American subjects up in his poetry, the promise and problems of democracy and equality. I think that's really what qualifies him as one of our most important poets.
And David, he wrote about ordinary Americans as well. That was a lot of his appeal.
Oh, very much so. I mean, poetry had always been something that was reserved for the higher-ups, for the aristocracy. But Whitman thought about, you know, how do I reflect the common man and the common woman origins of American life. So he paid attention to people who poets had never paid attention to before: teamsters, common laborers, butchers, apprentices, slaves. All of these people end up in his poetry in a very celebratory manner.
And do you think then that that helped to widen his appeal or his appreciation by speaking to the ordinary American and pulling them into his literature?
I think that accounts for part of his appeal now in the 20th century. In the 19th century, when he was writing, people were not particularly interested in that kind of poetry. It didn't read like poetry, and it didn't sound like poetry to them. But certainly in the 20th century and in the 21st century now, all sorts of people come to Walt Whitman to find an affirmation or a representation of themselves. So I think that accounts for his popularity and influence in later years, not at his time.
I want to talk a little bit about his early life, because he was born, obviously, 1819, lived through the Civil War, born during a really interesting and compelling time in American history. Tyler Hoffman, what do we know about Walt Whitman's early life?
Well, we know that he was born 200 years ago today on Long Island. And we also know that he had a very short formal education. He stopped going to school at about the age of 11, and really because he needed to help support his family. And he went through a number of occupations, I think primarily printer. He was very interested in the print trade and very knowledgeable about it, had a lot of experience setting type, and this came into play when he was publishing his own books. He would set the type himself most of the time, so he had a very keen interest in the way that his poetry looked on the page and actually had a hand in designing it. And he was notably a journalist in New York, in Brooklyn, where he lived until he moved to Washington, D.C. To help take care of wounded soldiers. But he had a very long career, relatively long career as a journalist and editor at newspapers in New York.
I want to talk a little bit about that, David, about his mm-hmm. career as a journalist. I had read somewhere that his journalistic work was not necessarily all that impressive, although there was a great body of it. But I'm curious as to how you think his work as a journalist may have informed his work as a poet.
Sure. Well, one thing is, as a journalist, a reporter, he got out into the city. He got out seeing people, seeing how things operated. He went to the theater. He went to the opera. He interviewed people. So he was very much a person of the urban environment. So that had a lot of influence. The other thing is he was used to writing with the public in mind. Newspapers at the time, as they do today, were very concerned with a sense of we have a public mission. And I think Whitman carried that over from his days as an editor of the newspaper to his mission in Leaves of Grass, that this was not simply an expression of his own ideas or thoughts. This was something that was as much about his readers, as much about us, as it was about him.
And may have been a little bit ahead of his time in that respect, because we see a lot of that in journalism today, but something that he was thinking about 200 years ago. Tyler, you mentioned that he spent some time working with wounded soldiers. How did he come to do that?
Well, the reason that he left Brooklyn to go to Washington, D.C. is that he had read that his brother had been injured in the Battle of Fredericksburg. So what took him there was really to see how his brother was and whether he was near death or in need of any kind of assistance. Once he went down there, he stayed because he saw a real need in the army hospitals in the city of Washington. And he ended up spending several years there tending to both Union and Confederate soldiers. We might think of him as a nurse. He wasn't officially a nurse, but he would go to these wards with candies and ice cream and other treats, and he would write letters home for the wounded soldiers and bestow affection on these wounded soldiers in a way that he felt was desperately needed.
Did that show up in his writing as well?
It did. He directly, in that he wrote a book called Drum Taps, which came out in 1865, just as the war was concluding. And it is a body of Civil War poetry that is considered some of the best Civil War poetry we have today. It is very different than a lot of other Civil War poetry. A lot of it was very partisan and righteous, right? God was on our side if it was a Union poem or if a Confederate poem, God on their side. Whitman was much more focused on the individual soldier and the plight of the individual soldier. And very unflinching about the wounds that these soldiers received. He talks about gangrene and things like that in his Civil War poetry that just weren't supposed to be talked about in poetry, even Civil War poetry. He really broke the mold there too, in his depictions of war and the effect of war on the common soldier.
Yeah. Speaking of breaking the mold, David, Leaves of Grass certainly is one of his works that is best known, best associated with him, but it was also controversial. What was that about, and why was it controversial?
Leaves of Grass was a book that found a way to be controversial decade after decade after decade, because Whitman decided early on that he was going to write simply one book of poems called Leaves of Grass, and he would add to it and change the contents of it and shape it every few years and then republish it as Leaves of Grass. So the book got bigger and bigger and bigger as the years went by. Initially, what offended people about it was it's just sort of frank language. It's frank sexuality. Whitman was a poet of the body, and just as Tyler was talking about his Civil War poems in terms of their graphic depiction of wounds and the body in pain, Leaves of Grass also includes a great deal about the body and pleasure, and a lot about sexual desire. And he was one of these poets who came out and said, this is part of who we are. I'm the poet of the body as well as the soul, which was a really kind of radical thing for poetry to do. So that found a way to become controversial through over about 50 years, well, not 50, for 40 years, as different generations would read the book and discover new poems or discover new things to be upset about.
Why did he feel compelled to keep working on that particular work? You said that he rewrote it and added to it and changed it over a period of many years.
Right. So he, at the end of his life, he wrote this essay called A Backwards Glance Over Traveled Roads. And in that, he looks back and he says, I've had this sort of 30-year career with this book. And this book represents an outcropping of my personality. And as it has changed over that time, and how the nation has changed over that time, because the two are very much intermingled for Whitman, both the self and the nation in which the self lives.
I want to talk about his nicknames. There are two that come to mind. Tyler, one is the Poet of Democracy. How did he get that nickname?
Well, I think really on the strength of the poetry and the subjects that he dealt with in his poetry. He was very careful about looking intensively at common people and insisting on the equality of all people, even if in some instances his private remarks did not live up to the poetry itself. But he is very clear in his poetry about putting men and women on equal terms, on equal footing. He celebrates the slave. He has a passage in Song of Myself about a runaway slave and taking that slave in and standing ready to protect that slave. He saw commonality across peoples, and I think his poetry reflects that time and again.
What you said is so interesting, and when we come back from our break in just a few minutes, I want to address that, because there certainly is some contradiction around what he wrote about slavery and some of his private remarks, and so it's one of the reasons that he's controversial, and we'll want to unpack that. In fact, I understand from one of our callers that there may be some protests going on in Camden even now around that subject. But David Blake, the Good Gray Poet was another nickname of his in our 30 seconds before the break. How did that come
about? So the Good Gray Poet came about after the Civil War, when Whitman had spent all that time volunteering in the hospitals. By this point, he wasn't the young man who was sort of the sexual braggart. He was a bearded, older man with flowing white hair. He had a very grandfatherly presence, and that's the way that people accepted him into American society.
Well, when we come back, we'll take a closer look at Walt Whitman's complicated legacy around issues of race, sexuality, and even self-promotion. There's more on Radio Times just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moscoene. May 31st marks the 200th anniversary of the birth of Walt Whitman, the American writer who came to be known as the Poet of Democracy. This hour, we're exploring the impact of Whitman's work and the complexities of his character. Our guests are Tyler Hoffman, professor of English at Rutgers Camden, and David Blake, professor of English at the College of New Jersey and author of two books on Walt Whitman. We want to hear from you as well, so you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or, of course, you can always call us 888-477-9499. Tyler and David, as you mentioned just a few minutes ago, Walt Whitman's legacy is complicated. He seemed to, on the one hand, oppose slavery, but also was accused of being racist in some of his private remarks about African Americans. So what do we know about that, and how can we square these seemingly opposing ideas?
Yeah, we know that he made some disparaging remarks about African Americans in private, and that is revealed in some of the conversations that were recorded by Horace Traubel during the last years of his life. Horace Traubel was taking notes about everything Whitman said.
And he was a friend of
Whitman's,
right?
but also in some of his private writings that weren't published. It's interesting, speaking of The Good Gray Poet, the book that his friend William O'Connor wrote. William O'Connor, a good friend of Whitman's, and Whitman had a big falling out in 1872 over the 15th Amendment, black male suffrage. O'Connor was very much for it. Whitman was against it. And so we have evidence like that, but we also have remarks that he makes that clearly want to favor the white working class over black Americans. And I think there is a fear on Whitman's part that freed blacks will take jobs away from white working class Americans, but often couched in very disparaging terms. And that is on the one side of the scale, and on the other side of the scale is this poetry that reflects none of that. And so how do you square it? I don't know how you square it. It doesn't – it's completely inconsistent with the record of the poetry. You would not have a sense of that from the poetry, but it doesn't mean that it can be ignored.
Well, on that subject, I want to go to the phones to Tim, who has been patiently waiting to join our conversation and has something to add to that. Tim, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Tracy, and to your guest. As we speak, I do have people protesting the event in Camden. And it is precisely because it has nothing to do with Whitman's poetry, but his words are also private words. His words are also the things that are unpublished, and they were very disparaging toward African Americans. My great-grandfather was a contemporary of Whitman and walked the same Camden streets as Whitman. And to think that Whitman would look upon him as a baboon, as he expressed in seeking to deny the black people the vote, is just reprehensible. So we have decided that we would not square it, that, you know, we will have to stand by his words, and we will not honor someone that we view as dishonorable. 200 years from now, I don't want people to laud Donald Trump's economy and ignore his xenophobia and his support for white supremacy. And so Whitman being a clear white supremacist through his statements and his sentiments and his allegiance to race theory at the time, in our estimation, especially in Camden, a city full of people of color who are going toward an inclusive and egalitarian city that is new, that the city that Whitman talks about is invincible, we have no room for these racist ideas. And so that's why we're in protest today.
Well, Tim, I want to thank you for adding that to the conversation. Thank you for calling in, and I want to give our guests an opportunity to talk about that. I know, Tyler, you have addressed it a little bit, but interesting that these protests are taking place at the same time, because how do you square those kinds of things?
Right. I think Tim was right in saying that they don't want to square that, and interestingly enough, and ironically enough, Whitman is somebody who you know, embraces that notion of rebellion and that notion of protest and that notion of we have to expand our sense of equality. He continually failed in that in his personal life, but the poetry is always trying to push us and nudge us towards seeing things in a more expansive way. And oftentimes art will do that, right? You know, we can achieve a certain perfection in art that we can't in our lives. So I really appreciate what Tim and his Camdenites are doing.
Yeah. It speaks to the complexity of who we all are as human beings. Tyler, what do we know from Walt Whitman's writings about his sexuality?
Well, I guess I would start with the Calamus cluster. So in the 1860 edition of Leaves of Grass, he writes a sequence of 45 poems under the title Calamus, which is the name of a plant that grows by the margins of pond waters. And he identifies that place as a place where men can be affectionate with other men. And so the 45 poems of Calamus are all about male-male affection. And he has a counterweight to that in the 1860 edition of Leaves of Grass, a section, a cluster called Children of Adam, which is about heterosexual love. But the Calamus poems have been taken by many people as a sign of his homosexuality. And they are very tender poems. They don't have the graphic sexual quality of the Children of Adam poems, ironically, and so weren't as controversial as the Children of Adam poems, believe it or not. But they express repeatedly the tender affection that actually he believes will help bind the nation between men and other men.
David, with that in mind, what does Walt Whitman mean to the LGBTQ community?
Well, I think in many ways he's seen as a great hero and a great champion. Here's somebody who not only in these early poems, meditates on same-sex desire, but at the same time, he says that this is at the very heart of American public life. And it's only going to be in that continuum of same-sex desire and same-sex attraction and same-sex bonding that we're going to achieve the kind of unity that we would need as a nation. So it's not seen as something that is marginalized or distant or simply private from public life, but it's really kind of at the very center of who we are as a nation.
Do you think that his poetry then could be read two different ways, that a heterosexual person could read his writing in one way and a homosexual person in a completely different way?
Well, I think it would be hard. Yes and no. I think it would be hard to read the Calamus poems and not come away with the intense homoeroticism of them. And I think what also has to come into play here is Whitman's own distancing of himself from a sexual reading of that work and other work of his. So late in his life, John Addington Symonds, a British poet who was instrumental in helping to study and define homosexuality, wrote Whitman a letter saying, oh, those Calamus poems, those are really great. And Whitman wrote back and said, oh, you have it all wrong. That is not what I meant. By the way, I have six children. Well, as it turned out, Symonds had four, so that's really not an indicator of anything. But he was at times wary of the sexual reading of his work, even though it lends itself to that so obviously.
Yeah. Talk about complexity.
If I can jump in, part of that, I think, is that the notions of sexuality had changed from 1855 to 1860 to then in the 1880s, that previously there really wasn't any thought about homosexuality or heterosexuality. Those terms were not used. People didn't conceive of the world in those ways. But by the 1880s, there was some thought about homosexuality and questions of maybe this is a kind of perversion or deviancy. And so Whitman became very self-protective and not wanting to be associated with that. But when he was writing in the 1860s, people didn't bat an eye.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about the 200th anniversary of the birth of Walt Whitman. And gentlemen, I'd like to talk about Whitman's tendency toward self-promotion. David Blake, you write about some of the tactics that he used to kind of increase his public profile. In today's world, it would be getting more likes, I suppose. But
right.
What were some of the things that he did to kind of broaden his recognition?
Right. So Whitman had a real evangelistic spirit about his poetry. He felt that Leaves of Grass was central to the success of the United States. And the only way that he could get his message out was to convince others that, indeed, this was the book they should go to. So he did all sorts of things. He took a private letter from Ralph Waldo Emerson that congratulated him on, quote, the beginning of a great career. And he took that quote and put it on the cover of his book. He may have invented the blurb doing that act. He wrote self-reviews in various newspapers to promote his work, some of them which were negative, but still put him out in the public light.
So anonymously,
exactly. And then later in life, he became very clever in terms of using photography to create an image of himself, to conform to that idea of the good gray poet. He created controversies that created tension between the United States and Britain, convincing England that people in the U.S. were disparaging of him and his poetry and neglecting him, which created this almost kind of international conflict as people sort of ran to his defense. So he's a very clever self-promoter, very clever in terms of advertising, which he had learned a lot from being a newspaper editor.
Wow. The term fake news comes to mind as I listen to all of this. We actually have a recording of one of his poems that I'd like for both of you to hear that sort of is in line with this tendency towards self-promotion, and we can talk about it on the other side. But let's take a listen to that poem.
I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. My tongue, every atom of my blood formed from the soil, this air, born here of parents born from parents the same, and their parents the same. I, now 37 years old in perfect health, begin, hoping to cease not till death. Creeds and schools in abeyance, retiring back a while, sufficed at what they are, but never forgotten. I harbor for good or bad. I permit to speak at every hazard, nature without check, with original energy.
That was WHYY's own Al Banks with a reading of Song of Myself, which certainly speaks to self-promotion. Tyler, what do you make of that?
Well, he is very canny at putting himself out there. And again, there's so much about that passage that was read that is unusual for poetry at that time, right? First of all, we kind of learn to think of the speaker of a poem and the poet as two different creatures, right? That the poet is creating a persona, perhaps, in the poem. But, you know, we should be careful about assuming that the speaker of the poem is the poet. Well, it's hard not to do that here, right? I, now 37 years old, in perfect health, begin, hoping to cease not till death.
Yeah, there's no mistaking.
There's no mistaking it. And later in the poem, he will call himself by name, Walt Whitman. It reminds me of pop stars today and hip-hop artists today who are very self-referential, right? They will speak their name, sometimes very often, in a song. And so he's really just putting himself out there. I celebrate myself and sing myself. But as the verse goes on, it's clear that he wants everyone reading this poem to celebrate themselves, just mm-hmm. as he is celebrating himself. That we're all kind of miracles of creation. And I think also the last part of the poem, creeds and schools, or this section of the poem, creeds and schools in abeyance. Right. That captures a lot about Whitman. Right. Keep at bay, you know, theologies and schools of thought, these rigid frameworks that are supposed to govern our thinking and what he believes stymies our thinking. He says they're good for what they are, but they need to be put in their place.
So as I was listening to that poem and just in listening to you talk about him, you said that he really sort of took poetry off the page in the sense that it wasn't just to be read, but now to be spoken. And do you think that today's modern spoken word movement is sort of a logical extension of what Walt Whitman started?
I do. In some ways, the spoken word movement today does incorporate some conventional poetic effects like rhyme and meter, but not always. So there might be some tension there. But I think, as you point out, Whitman is trying to bring the words of the poem off the page. Of course, they're in a book and they're in print, but he's trying to give them an oral liveliness. And one of the things in the one of the devices he uses in the 1855 edition of Leaves of Grass in Song of Myself are what scholars call dot devices, and there are these long ellipses between words and phrases that are very much like what you find in the Declaration of Independence, because these texts were imagined as being scored for vocal performance. And so these are pauses that are being inserted into the text. And so when you look at things like that, you see that Whitman is really very interested in having his poetry declaimed, whether actually or figuratively, that it's meant to be heard in the world. And he was a great devotee of vocal performance, whether it be opera or oratory.
Preaching.
Elias Hicks.
Well, yes, and David Blake, you write about the influence of opera on his work.
Opera was a great, great favorite of Whitman's, and he loved going to the opera when he lived in New York City, and you know, identified so much with the soprano, and he includes passages in Song of Myself about hearing the soprano and just sort of doubling over in joy at her song. So that oratory aspect that Tyler was talking about is very strong here in all sorts of ways, whether it's singing, right? He's singing himself, whether it's appearing in the guise of a lecturer, which he does later in the poem, where he stands up and gives a lecture to a crowd of people. He sees this as something, as he says, you know, readers, you know, what you hold in your hands is not a book, it's a man. I want you to see this as being a person. And that identification of text with self is something that's very much about him. It's about Walt Whitman, this creature we call, person we call Walt Whitman, but it's also about who we are and who we could potentially be ourselves.
Fascinating character indeed. When we come back, Camden, New Jersey was the city that Walt Whitman called home in the latter years of his life. We'll look at the time that he spent there and in Philadelphia and how both cities are honoring his legacy. Radio Times will be right back. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowain. This hour, we are looking back on the life of Walt Whitman as America celebrates the 200th anniversary of his birth. Our guests are Tyler Hoffman, professor of English at Rutgers Camden, and David Blake, professor of English at the College of New Jersey. Of course, we want to hear from you as well. So tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or call us 888-477-9499. So we have mentioned that Walt Whitman spent the last couple of decades of his life in Camden, New Jersey, and that he also spent some time in Philadelphia. What brought him, Tyler, to Camden?
What brought him to Camden for an initial visit was that his mother was very sick. And this was in 1873, in the spring of 1873. And he came up here to see her. As it turned out, she died just a few days after he made his visit. He went back to D.C. and decided he was going to move to Camden, move in with his brother and sister-in-law. And he did that in 1873. He said that it was a happy accident that he ended up in Camden and that it brought him many blessed returns. But I think the real reason he ended up there was because of the strong tie he had to his mother. He lamented her death for a very long time, and to have a place to live, you know, with his brother and sister-in-law there.
Are there parallels as you think about him living in Camden near Philadelphia? At some point, he was in Brooklyn, across the river from New York as well. Was that was there a connection?
They were very parallel situations. I mean, he had grown up in Brooklyn and Long Island. His father was a carpenter, and they tended to sort of live in homes as they were building them, and then move on, sell the home, and move on to another one. And then when he was an editor, he also was living in Brooklyn and taking the ferry across the East River into Manhattan in the evening for entertainment. One of his great poems is Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. So here he is now in old age, and he's living in Camden, a more working class a city right next to Philadelphia, which was much more wealthy and much more developed. And he's taking the ferries across the river again and coming to Philadelphia.
Yeah. How was he received in Camden? What did people in Camden think of him? Did they know him well? What was his reputation there, Tyler?
Yeah, I think he was just considered one of the guys. I mean, I think he fit right into the landscape of Camden. At the time, when the Delaware River was wider than it is now, his house was only a couple of blocks from the river. It was on a bustling thoroughfare, Mickle Street, so he could just look out and watch the street life go by. I think he was known as a poet, but I don't think that he was, for the residents of Camden, quite a celebrity, except for some who were more in the know about his literary reputation. But I think he just blended in, to be quite honest.
And I imagine, David, that there would have been a lot of inspiration in Camden because he was such a man of the people and so interested in studying ordinary people.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And again, this returns him to the working class and to common laborers. And he knows the people who are in that neighborhood. And at the same time, though, he's receiving visits from writers and artists from around the world. So Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, comes to Camden to see Walt Whitman. Oscar Wilde, the Irish poet and playwright, comes to Camden to see Walt Whitman. So he blends in exactly as Tyler is saying, but he's also receiving, you know, tremendous visitors from overseas, and a lot of important people are making their way to Mickle Street to come into contact with the good great poet.
So they know there's something special about this guy.
Yes.
Because a lot of VIPs are showing
Yes.
up on his doorstep, which brings me to a question I was curious about, and this comes from some of your writing, David, about his fascination, if you will, with celebrity, or how he placed a certain level of importance on celebrity. And there were some things that he wrote that sounded as if he almost viewed his own value in terms of how well he was valued by his readers. Can you talk a little bit about
that? Yes, yes. And I would slightly quibble with the wording of that, in the sense that Whitman was not interested in the celebrities of his era. He was not somebody who was impressed with wealth or beauty or prestige. These things didn't matter to him whatsoever. He was like the least glamorous person around. But what he was interested in was fame as a kind of popular acceptance, that fame meant an affirmation of who the self was. Every American, he thought, should strive to be a personality. And the way in which you were a personality is you had an impact upon the crowd and the people around you. He tells a pupil to rivet yourself and publish your personality. And so there is this deep longing on his part for an affirmation that all that he said in Leaves of Grass to come true, that audience that he imagines that he's lecturing to or singing in front of materializes, that it's there. But that's a different kind of phenomenon, I think, than somebody who might be interested in glamour. Because that wasn't him at all.
As you're saying that, I'm imagining him modern day on Facebook, on Twitter, as someone who would make strong use of social media.
Yeah. Oh, I think so. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
I think he would want to get his word out, and he knew and reflected on the fact, you know, in his published writings, that Leaves of Grass was not the success he hoped it would be.
Yeah.
So I think he would have used those social media platforms primarily to reach his audience and hope that audience absorbed him.
What was his relationship like with some of the contemporaries of his time? You mentioned that he had some very high-profile visitors that showed up at his front door, but you had, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson, people like that who were in existence around the same time. And how did he relate to those people? What was his relationship like with some of his contemporaries in literature?
Well, certainly as a young man, as a young poet, he looked to Emerson as a mentor. And Emerson, even though he was annoyed about the publication, the unauthorized publication of his letter, Emerson accepted Whitman in that way and worked with him, though they had a very interesting kind of break in 1860. in which Emerson tried to convince Whitman to tone down the sexuality in his poems, the Children of Adam poems that we had been talking about before. And they walked around Boston Common with Emerson sort of urging him, you know, take some of this out. And Whitman realized then that he was on a different aesthetic path than Emerson, and he had to go his own way. But, you know, by the time he reaches Camden in Philadelphia, Whitman is the good great poet. He's somebody who brings with him a great deal of attention, and people start to gather around him, and they want to support him. He's living in, you know, just above poverty, and he can't work. I mean, he's had a series of strokes, and so a lot of people of the time, wealthy people in Philadelphia and New York, you know, try to find ways to hold fundraisers for him to support somebody who now is becoming to be seen as a national treasure.
And he did spend time in the city of Philadelphia. Tyler, what brought him across the river to Philly?
His friends. He often would come and visit, take the ferry across and visit his friends in Philadelphia. Notably, he also attended the 1876 Centennial Exposition in Fairmount Park, so we would go to cultural celebrations like that as well. And there's this wonderful piece of writing that he composed about one of his trips back from the Centennial Exposition and seeing City Hall half built, and it's he's just in awe of its monumentality even at that point in its construction. And so he took notes around the city, and these became published. These were published ultimately in a book of his called Specimen Days, where there are a number of vignettes of his time spent in Philadelphia. But he would come over and visit Thomas Aikens, the Gilchrists, and other people that would host him for dinner. And so he had a really lively social calendar based in Philly, and really the only thing that got in the way of that as time went on was his own physical disability.
So let's talk about that. What happened, and how did his health, David, begin to decline while he was living in Camden?
Well, he had had a stroke earlier, and then he came to Camden, and you know, like many people who struggle with disability and who age, his health would sort of ebb and flow, right? And he liked to give lectures on the anniversary of Lincoln's assassination, and this became a really important part of what he would do for the country. And sometimes he had to cancel those lectures. He canceled several in Philadelphia because he was too sick. But one of the interesting things about Whitman, and I think we're going to see more and more of this as Whitman's studies grows, is he wrote a lot about old age. For a poet who came out as a swaggering young man, starting as 37 years old in perfect health, he writes many, many poems at the end of his life about what it is like to be paralyzed, half paralyzed, what it's like to be an invalid, what it's like to have somebody care for you. And this becomes a really interesting part of his aesthetic and a part of Leaves of Grass.
Yeah, so in keeping with that sort of social media kind of mentality, right, that sort of writing about where you are, posting about what's going on in your mm-hmm. life right now over time. And I wonder, when you were talking about him giving lectures about Lincoln, would he recite "O Captain, My Captain" at those kinds of events?
Oh, yes, that was the end. So he had a beautiful recollection of Lincoln's death and setting up all the historical and political forces behind it. It's very dramatic. But then it would always end with his reciting "O Captain, My Captain," which, you know, had become a great crowd pleaser. Even though it was so different from the rest of Leaves of Grass, it was something that people grabbed onto right away.
And it was one of his poems that was not in his sort of freer style of writing, right? This one really did adhere to rhyme, meter, more conventional poetry when we think of it.
Sure, absolutely. It yeah. rhymes. It's easily memorized. And, you know, in times of personal and political crisis, Whitman would often retreat to more conventional forms of verse.
And it allowed people to I guess, help them to remember, perhaps, when you have something that rhymes and it just sort of sticks in the mind and sort of makes it more accessible, maybe,
yes,
yeah, to the people of the time. And by the way, speaking of O Captain, My Captain, beyond reading that piece, if you haven't seen Dead Poets Society in a while, you need to just go on YouTube and pull up that scene. It's a wonderful scene from that movie, and it certainly recalls Walt Whitman. Tyler Hoffman, how has Camden memorialized Walt Whitman's time in the city?
Well, thankfully, we have his house intact, and more than intact. It was preserved over the years in a way that is almost inexplicable, because it was a simple row home. You think of other important literary figures, American literary figures, and you think of these grand mansions that have, of course, been preserved over time because they weren't really in the wrecking ball's way. But Whitman's house, the house that he bought, still stands. It was renovated by the state about 10 years ago with meticulous, with an attention to detail that is incredible and meticulous. And you really can get a sense of him when you enter the house, and some of the original items that he used are there. These artifacts include boots and his rocking chair and knapsack, and these things bring him alive in Camden. The fact that there's a proclamation ceremony going on today in front of the house by the city suggests, I think, their recognition of the cultural treasure they have in that house, and a visitor center is planned finally to go up next to it. So I think the real gem and the real point of memorialization of Whitman in Camden is the Walt Whitman House.
Before we wrap up the show, I would like for us to share with our listeners one more piece of Walt Whitman's poetry, and then we'll come back and talk before we have to go. But we have a recording of I Hear America Singing. We thought that would be a fitting tribute on the 200th anniversary of his birth. So here it is.
I hear America singing, the varied carols I hear, those of mechanics, each one singing his, as it should be blithe and strong. The carpenter singing his, as he measures his plank or beam. The mason singing his, as he makes ready for work or leaves off work. The boatman singing what belongs to him in his boat. The deckhand singing on the steamboat deck. The shoemaker singing as he sits on his bench. The hatter singing as he stands. The woodcutter's song. The plowboy's on his way in the morning, or at noon intermission, at sundown. The delicious singing of the mother, or the young wife at work, or the girl sewing or washing. Each singing what belongs to him or her, and to none else. The day what belongs to the day. At night, the party of young fellows, robust, friendly, singing with open mouths their strong, melodious songs.
And that is I Hear America Singing, Walt Whitman, in his characteristic fashion, observing ordinary people writing about America, and one of the reasons he was called the poet of democracy. I want to take a moment to thank our guests for being with us. We've had Tyler Hoffman, professor of English at Rutgers Camden, David Blake, professor of English at the College of New Jersey. Thanks to both of you for helping us to understand the complexities and the character of Walt Whitman, a beloved poet in America. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. So our engineer today is Diana Martinez. Our producers have been John Ahrens, Kelsey Hansen, and Debbie Builder. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. You have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.